loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Walter Smolarek, filling in for Brian Becker, and joined in studio by John Kiriakou. In this hour, we take a look at several big stories. First, co-host Brian Becker joins us from Hanoi after a disappointing and abrupt end to the Vietnam summit between President Trump and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. And then we continue our weekly series, Criminal Injustice, where we talk about the most egregious conduct of the courts and prosecutors and how justice is denied to so many people in this country.
But before we get to those stories, we'll go over today's headlines. Rona McDaniel, chair of the Republican National Committee, sought to discourage potential primary challengers to President Trump today, saying, quote, "They have the right to jump in and lose. That's fine. They'll lose horribly," unquote. Former Ohio Governor John Kasich and current Maryland Governor Larry Hogan are rumored to be considering a primary challenge. Venezuelan opposition leader Juan Guaido met with European Union ambassadors to Brazil, publicly with the Brazilian foreign minister, and then privately with right-wing Brazilian President Jair Bolsonaro. Despite Brazil recognizing Guaido as the leader of Venezuela, he will not receive the formal honors that foreign dignitaries traditionally get. Guaido will meet with Paraguay's President Mario Abdo tomorrow. State Department data was released today showing that 37,000 visas were denied in 2018 due to President Trump's travel ban. This had an outsized effect on people applying for visas from Iran, Libya, Somalia, Syria, and Yemen, where the number of visas was 80% lower than in 2016, the last year with no travel ban. More than 15,000 immigrant visas were denied, and more than 21,000 visas for tourism, business, visits to family, medical procedures, or other short-term reasons were denied. Former Maine Governor Paula Page today said in reference to a bill that would abolish the Electoral College, quote, "What would happen if they do what they say they're going to do is white people will not have anything to say. It's only going to be the minorities that would elect. It would be California, Texas, Florida. We're going to be forgotten people," unquote, apparently referencing white people. Those are today's headlines. You're listening to Loud and Clear.
Loud and Clear.
And now we turn to the summit in Vietnam between North Korean leader Kim Jong-un and Donald Trump. Talks between President Trump and North Korean leader Kim ended today with no agreement on any issue. Kim said that he would continue a moratorium on missile testing and development, but the fate of future negotiations remained very much in doubt. Can the peace process be put back on track? We're joined from Hanoi by our own Brian Becker, who is there covering the summit. Welcome back, Brian.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
So this was a surprising and quite disappointing outcome. What's your take?
Yeah, it was very surprising. I mean, we were all sitting in the International Media Center. They had handed out a schedule long in advance, which included, after a one-on-one meeting that took place earlier in the day between Donald Trump and Kim Jong-un. It wasn't simply between the two of them. They also had some of their principals with them, including Mike Pompeo and Mulvaney, and on the case of for Trump, General Kim Jong-jol from the North Korean side. He's been the key confidant of Kim Jong-un. He was present. So, yeah, they were there in the meeting. You could see them. The meeting lasted a little bit longer. Then there was supposed to be a lunch break and then a signing ceremony. And that was going to take place a little bit after 2 p.m. today. And then after that, there was to be a press conference. So at the late morning, we got the word that something had changed, that there was some scheduling issues. Then the word came, the signing ceremony, in fact, was canceled. Donald Trump was going to hold a press conference by himself, not with Kim Jong-un, before he headed back on Air Force One earlier than scheduled. So at the end, it became clear to everyone that whatever they expected to have happen came undone. So I would say for the people present, maybe not the hardened, you know, cynical, imperial-oriented White House press corps, but for almost all the other journalists, and certainly for the people in Vietnam, and most importantly for the people of Korea, there can't be but disappointment in terms of the outcome here.
Brian, the press this morning is unanimous here in that this was a major loss for Donald Trump, but still a victory for Kim Jong-un, because Kim Jong-un, again, was given equal billing with arguably the most powerful man in the world, And he also extracted a promise of another summit at some point in the relatively near future. Do you agree that this was bad for Trump and good for Kim, or did both sides lose because of no agreement?
Yeah, again, this is the banal, superficial, disgusting coverage of the U.S. media. But of course, behind this disgusting, banal coverage is a political orientation, which is not just absolute hostility and animus towards Donald Trump, no matter what he does, even if he does something good, which this would be something good, having peace in Korea. But they also have a consensus position of absolute hostility towards peace breaking out on the Korean Peninsula. They don't want better relations between the United States and North Korea. They want regime change in North Korea. And to the extent that Trump has entered into negotiations, they consider it to be legitimizing the government in North Korea, which should and must be toppled. So, yeah, their coverage should be understood as having a political agenda behind it. But let's get to the specifics of what you just said, John. Is this a victory for Kim Jong-un and a defeat for Donald Trump? It's a setback for Donald Trump. It's also a setback for Kim Jong-un. It's a big setback because what is Kim Jong-un really trying to do? This isn't like some sort of playground match between two kids. What Kim Jong-un is trying to do is to allow his country to escape the draconian, severe economic sanctions that are having a huge impact on the people of that country. That's 30 million human beings. And he wants to integrate into the world economy so that, like other countries in Asia, including, say, Vietnam, where I am right now, their country can start to thrive economically. Right now, economic sanctions that have been imposed on DPRK using the nuclear weapons issue as a pretext, and I want to emphasize that, as a pretext, they remain in place. Now, Kim Jong-un, when he came here and his team came here, and they came all the way from Pyongyang, from North Korea, on a train, they expected that there was going to be an agreement. So what happened? There was obviously some change at the scene of the summit meetings, different from what they had expected. Otherwise, they would not have gone all the way out and put themselves out on the limb to do this. So I think it's a setback for Donald Trump as a political leader. It's a setback for Kim Jong-un, perhaps as a political leader, but certainly as the leader of a country of people who wants to escape sanctions. But most importantly, it's a big loss for the people of Korea. I mean, we're talking about human beings, and we're talking about a part of the world that's been at war since 1950, and really 1945. You can precede it another 5 years. 10 million families divided who couldn't see each other and haven't seen each other because of this artificial division. It was Dean Rusk. You remember Dean Rusk, John.
Oh, sure.
I mean, he was a 25-year-old, and he took a magic marker and drew it across the 38th parallel of the Korean Peninsula, demarcating the Soviet zone of influence in the north and the American zone of influence in the south. That's how this people, this proud, unitary people, culturally, linguistically, culturally united people, have become divided. And for the American media to say, oh, this is a win for Kim Jong-un and a setback for Trump, and reduce it to that and ignore the human factor, shows that these people actually don't care about human beings. And I think that should be a big takeaway as we continue to assess and analyze why did this happen, what's coming next, which we want to do in the course of this discussion. And I know you have audio clips from the press conference today. I don't want people to lose the sort of focus on human beings, on people, and what it means for them.
Well, let's listen to one of those clips. This is from Donald Trump's press conference right after the end of the summit, which he actually departed early.
We spent pretty much all day with Kim Jong-un, who is, he's quite a guy and quite a character, and I think our relationship is very strong. But at this time, we had some options, and at this time, we decided not to do any of the options, and we'll see where that goes. But it was a very interesting 2 days, and I think actually it was a very productive 2 days. But sometimes you have to walk, and this was just one of those times.
So very vague and confused language coming from Donald Trump. I mean, what happened? It's a mystery to me.
Okay, so let's listen to what Donald Trump said in that clip. And I think you have another clip that we're going to hear in a little bit. But what he said is that he said he characterized Kim Jong-un as quite a character, quite a guy. He said it was an interesting 2 days. He said it was a productive 2 days. He obviously wasn't trying to say this was a rancorous meeting and the negotiations are over and they can never talk again. He didn't talk like that. Trump used different kind of language. He sort of praised Kim Jong-un. He said the country can still be an economic powerhouse. He said the problem was economic sanctions. They wanted the sanctions completely lifted. He made it also clear that there was, in addition to the Yongbyon, a nuclear facility, the primary nuclear facility of the DPRK, which the North Koreans were obviously prepared to close in exchange for the lifting or partial lifting of economic sanctions, that wasn't enough for the United States, that the U.S., perhaps U.S. intelligence had reports that they confronted Kim Jong-un with about other nuclear facilities of a lesser character. Mike Pompeo, in his comments, also talked about missiles and warheads, meaning things that aren't related to the Yongbyon nuclear facility. It appears to me that what happened is that the North Koreans thought they were coming to a meeting with an understanding that they were going to close the Yongbyon nuclear facility in exchange for the beginning of the lifting of sanctions. And what the Trump team came back to them and said is, that's not enough. You have to get rid of all the nuclear facilities everywhere in the country, and we have to have a declaration, an inventory. This is what I think Pompeo was referring to in his comments, an inventory of all of the existing warheads and nuclear and missile systems that exist so that they can all be probably monitored, verified through intrusive inspections and so on. And absent that, short of that, we're not going to lift sanctions at all.
Well, let's listen to those comments by Secretary Pompeo, and then we'll get your assessment of them.
We made real progress, and indeed we made even more progress when the two leaders met over the last 24, 36 hours. Unfortunately, we didn't get all the way. We didn't get to something that ultimately made sense for the United States of America. I think Chairman Kim was hopeful that we would. We asked him to do more. He was unprepared to do that. But I'm still optimistic. I'm hopeful that the teams will get back together in the days and weeks ahead and continue to work out. It's a very complex problem. We have said since the beginning that this would take time. Our teams have gotten to know each other better. We know what the limits are. We know where some of the challenges are. And I think as we continue to work on this in the days and weeks ahead, we can make progress so that we can ultimately achieve what it is that the world wants, which is to denuclearize North Korea, to reduce risk for the American people and the people all around the world. I wish we could have gotten a little bit further, but I'm very optimistic that the progress that we made, both in the run-up to this summit, as well as the progress that the two leaders made over these past 2 days, put us in position to get a really good outcome. The President, Chairman Kim, both felt good that they had made that progress, but couldn't quite get along the line any further to make a deal that would have been bigger at this point. I hope we'll do so in the weeks ahead.
So again, I mean, expressing optimism about the future, but again, no deal. Go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, I'm actually glad to hear Pompeo once again, because you have to listen carefully. This is diplomatic language. There's the old cliche, diplomacy is just a form of perjury. There's something to that. At least it requires people to listen carefully to the words. What did Pompeo say? He said, we made real progress. Okay, that sounds good. He said, we didn't get all the way. He said, Chairman Kim wanted us to. So that means Kim wanted to make this agreement. He said, but we wanted more. Those were his words there. So the more was beyond the Yongbyon nuclear facility, more than what the North Koreans thought they were entering into an agreement about. And then did you catch the part at the end where Pompeo says we can finally achieve what the world wants, which is to denuclearize North Korea? I hadn't really, when I listened to it the first and second time, I didn't get the full impact of those words. Now, perhaps he's just speaking off the cuff and the words don't mean that much, but let's assume that they do mean something. What that says to me is Mike Pompeo, and I think Mike Pompeo, while he may be the point man for Donald Trump in trying to and Trump wants this deal, he may also have at least partly the opinion of John Bolton and other hardliners inside the Trump White House that don't really want this deal. Or maybe he's sort of ambivalent about it. But denuclearizing North Korea is not the basis of the Singapore summit. The Singapore summit declaration that was signed on June 12th, that became the foundation for this meeting, had 4 points. The first point was to improve the relations between the two countries and to end the war. Number two was to set up a peace mechanism. Number three was to set up a denuclearization for the entire Korean peninsula. And then point four was about the return of remains of those American soldiers who were killed during the Korean War. Now, Pompeo saying to denuclearize North Korea, that's not what North Korea wants. North Korea wants peace. North Korea wants a peace agreement. North Korea wants normalized relations with the United States. It obviously doesn't want a nuclear war with the United States. A nuclear war, they would not win. They would be annihilated. But here Pompeo is reverting to the language that was more akin to the Bolton language, even though at the same time he's saying they made progress, the two leaders. You know, he sounded soft and good and sort of warm and fuzzy. But of course, he's Donald Trump's Secretary of State, and he's standing next to Donald Trump at the dais there. And Trump must be disappointed because he invested a lot of capital. And even when you heard Trump's other comments, he talked about, I could have done this thing, but I talked to Mike a lot. We talked a lot. We discussed it a lot. And then we came to the conclusion that we didn't want to sign something that would not achieve what we actually need to achieve. Now, from that point of view, yes, if you can look at it this way, if the North Koreans have other nuclear facilities that the United States knew about, but the North Koreans didn't know the United States knew about them, and even if they're lesser facilities, if Donald Trump had signed an agreement and said, this is it, we're denuclearizing the Korean Peninsula, we're going to lift sanctions, and then U.S. intelligence agencies knew that these other nuclear facilities existed in North Korea, they would certainly leak that information to the media, right? And then Donald Trump would look like a fool. Donald Trump would look like he had been had by the North Koreans. So Donald Trump was actually had a very, very limited room for maneuver. Again, I say Donald Trump wanted the deal. He really wants the deal. He's the one trying to make it within Washington. All the other people are naysayers for the most part. And if the U.S. had this other ability to sort of corner Trump and Kim Jong-un, it made it almost impossible to go forward. Now, Trump got on Air Force One, and the reports from the media are that he had a 45-minute discussion with Moon Jae-in, the president of South Korea, who also has a lot at stake. I mean, his reputation is at stake here. He's been the driver of this along with Kim Jong-un. Tomorrow is March 1st. It's a very important day for both Koreas. It's the centennial of the beginning of the Korean independence movement, March 1st, 1919, 100 years ago tomorrow. And he was prepared to make a big speech about what he thought would be a historic breakthrough in the talks between the U.S. and the DPRK. And he was also going to announce new economic interaction between North and South Korea. Now, he may still do some of that, but let's remember, if the sanctions are not lifted, the sanctions are international sanctions, and thus, even though I say they're not legal sanctions, they have the force of law because they're by the UN Security Council, they prohibit any joint venture between any company anywhere in the world and a North Korean enterprise. That means South Koreans won't be able to trade with North Koreans or do business with North Koreans because even though they're one people on one country in one peninsula, they're actually under the legal guidance and restrictions of the UN Security Council resolution that was adopted by the five members of the Security Council. So that limits the ability of Moon Jae-in to do things economically with North Korea that could make a palpable difference from the point of view of doing what North Korea wants and what North Korea needs, which is to integrate into the world economy from which it's been excluded using nuclear weapons as a pretext.
Brian, one of the things that we're not seeing here in the media is any reaction at all from the South Koreans, either from Moon Jae-in or from the South Korean people. Tell us what you're hearing from South Koreans. Are they happy about the failure of this summit to come to any specific agreement? Or are they disappointed that that peace hasn't moved forward in any way?
Yeah, I mean, no, the South Koreans who are with Moon Jae-in are disappointed. I'm watching television. They're doing like man on the street interviews, man and women on the street interviews. The people in South Korea had high expectations. Their hopes have been dashed. I mean, they're very disappointed. And Moon Jae-in is, as I mentioned before, he has to be disappointed. And yeah, I think that it's quite clear that Moon Jae-in is going to do everything in his power, limited as it is, because as I mentioned, South Korea has limited sovereignty. It's got American troops, 30,000 of them on its soil. Many of the Pentagon is also aligned with the political parties that are Moon Jae-in's opponents, who really want to sabotage this thing for their own reasons, which is to regain political power inside of South Korea from Moon Jae-in. So this weakens Moon Jae-in. It strengthens his right-wing opponents in South Korea. Moon Jae-in has to fight back. He has limited room for maneuver. Donald Trump personally asked him to mediate. That means he knows that Trump isn't giving up. And Trump isn't giving up. I don't rule out the possibility of another summit, although I have to say I'm fairly skeptical given the I don't think Donald Trump could risk another sort of setback like this. I mean, it comes, well, the Michael Cohen hearings, which Trump characterized as fake hearings, which frankly is true, dominated the U.S. media so that while Trump is trying to do something good, which would be to bring peace to the Korean Peninsula, all the people in the United States heard about was Michael Cohen, who had absolutely nothing new to say. So that was a hit job, not just against Trump, but against the peace process in Korea. So that's one thing. And now the media critics will say, and Donald Trump was, as you said, John, in the beginning, they're playing it like Kim Jong-un is the big winner and Donald Trump's the big loser. That's a complete 100% lie. That's a fraudulent presentation. That's not true. Both sides are the losers here. But again, it doesn't matter because the media is pursuing its own nefarious agenda when it comes to Donald Trump. Again, we're not friends of Donald Trump. We're not political supporters of Donald Trump. But I think it's disgusting. And I think the U.S. corporate-owned media and the Democratic Party elites are actually to the right of Donald Trump when it comes to foreign policy in Northeast Asia and on the Korean Peninsula in particular.
In addition to the threat of a nuclear conflict breaking out in the Korean Peninsula, there's also a huge buildup of conventional military forces there. So you mentioned the 30,000 U.S. soldiers that have been in South Korea, you know, since the armistice in 1953. There's been, for years and years and years, regular military exercises that simulate the invasion and destruction of North Korea. Those have been either canceled or scaled down since diplomatic progress has been made. But as a consequence of the failure of this summit to reach an agreement, do you think that there's a possibility that those exercises might be resumed?
No, Donald Trump said he's not going to resume the exercises. It was interesting. He premised his remarks on the basis that they're a waste of money, which on its face, that's correct. They are a waste of money. The U.S., for instance, brings B-1 and B-2 bombers all the way from Nebraska flying nonstop. This costs millions of dollars, literally, to fly close to North Korea and sit and drop fake nuclear bombs close by and then fly straight back. Tens of thousands of troops. Donald Trump said today, he was asked, what about the war exercises? He said, no, that's not happening. That's over. Donald Trump also said, when he was asked, I think he was kind of being poked, will you impose bigger sanctions now on North Korea? He said, no, I don't want to talk about sanctions. And he made some allusion to, you know, the suffering of people. He said he wanted to lift the sanctions. He said, I want to lift the sanctions. I want North Korea to become an economic powerhouse. I still think it can be. He still praised Kim Jong-un. Donald Trump doesn't want anything other than he wants to make a deal on this. The other people who oppose Trump inside the establishment, they don't want a war with North Korea. I mean, you know, they fought a war with North Korea between 1950 and 53, and it didn't really work out that well for the United States. Yeah, 4 million Koreans died, but the United States lost 38,000 troops and was pushed all the way back from the Yalu River at the China-Korea border all the way south of the 38th parallel. And frankly, the North Koreans didn't want to stop fighting. Just like the Vietnamese, they knew if they kept fighting and fighting and fighting, eventually America would have to withdraw. It was a decision taken by the Joint Chiefs of Staff in May 1953, which was communicated to China and to the Soviet Union that the U.S. was going to imminently start dropping nuclear bombs on North Korea and on China unless the North Koreans agreed to an armistice to cease the war. That was on July 27th, 1953. So, you know, the U.S. doesn't want another war with Korea. But what they do want is to use sanctions to make life hard enough in North Korea and have put so much pressure on the North Korean regime that it starts to break apart. You know, Reagan put the full court press on the Soviet leadership, and the Soviet Union was much, much stronger than North Korea, at least in terms of magnitude. They put, you know, they ringed the Soviet Union with intermediate range missiles, put a lot of severe pressure on the Soviet Union economically, but especially through an arms race. And the calculation was that it would weaken the Soviet Union. I mean, I don't think they anticipated the full implosion of the Soviet government, which is what happened by the end of that decade. But I think that's what I think the policymakers in Washington still believe that they can overthrow the government of North Korea. They've overthrown a bunch of governments in South America. They overthrew Libya. They overthrew Iraq. They haven't given up on North Korea.
We have just a little bit over a minute left. Talk about the regional implications of what happened in Vietnam. Of course, Japan has a big interest in what the outcome of these talks are. China also has a big interest in the outcome of the negotiations. And of course, Vietnam, which was so proud to host this summit, they must have been disappointed too by what happened.
Vietnam is certainly disappointed. Abe said right away he stands with President Trump. The conservative political forces here in Asia are saluting Trump for being strong and not giving in. I think so it strengthens Abe and the right wing inside of Japan. China has been, what Trump is doing is he's stroking China. He's saying he has a great relationship with Xi Jinping, at the same time putting enormous pressure on China. He wants to make sure that China stays in the American camp, so to speak, imposing these severe economic sanctions on the DPRK. So there's a lot of pressure on China. So generally speaking, this is a big setback. I think we can't call it anything other than what it is. It doesn't mean it's the end of the road. It doesn't mean that there won't be a good final outcome. We don't have crystal balls. There's a lot of other pushback forces at play. But right now, I think when you look at it realistically with a sober assessment, this was a pretty big setback.
We're going to have to leave it right there. We've been joined from Hanoi by our own Brian Becker, who has been there covering the Trump-Kim summit. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Walter Smolarek, filling in for Brian Becker.
And I'm John Kiriakou.
Today we continue our weekly series, Criminal Injustice, where we talk about the most egregious conduct of the courts and prosecutors and how justice is denied to so many people in this country. We're joined from Chicago by Kevin Gastola. He's a writer for Shatterproof.com and co-host of the podcast Unauthorized Disclosure. And we're joined from Lake Worth, Florida by Paul Wright. He's the founder and executive director of the Human Rights Defense Center. He's also the editor of Prison Legal News and Criminal Legal News magazines. Welcome back, Kevin and Paul.
Hey, thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Kevin, let's start with you. In California, there's a new bill that was signed into law. The California Records Act is the title of it, and it goes into police accountability and transparency. Tell us more details on that.
Well, yeah, I mean, this would be an important law for California, and it seems like it would set a higher standard. It looks like people who advocate for transparency around police corruption and the sort of number of unfit officers wanting to have transparency around what they're doing that this would be helpful to them. And the police unions are opposed to it. It doesn't take much for the police unions to decide to oppose any modest legislation that would require them to have a higher level of accountability, which is right now they don't really have any in most states. So there is that. And I think what's important, it's not in this piece, but I imagine that Paul might raise it as well, have some additional thoughts, is that this past week we saw that the Attorney General, Xavier Becerra, actually threatened two Berkeley-based reporters in California because they were able to obtain, they say it's by accident, they obtained this list of criminal convictions that past cops have been and involved in this list of cops that are guilty of criminal misconduct that apparently are still working on forces in California police departments. And then they threatened these attorneys and said, you have to give it back, and going after them, attacking their free speech and press freedom. I mean, I think that just shows you, if you go back to this law, that this is going to be a flashpoint, because one of the things that the law, there's this whole discussion around whether, in fact, the police are going to be able to be allowed to destroy records before when this law went into effect, which it says it takes effect January 1st, 2019. So it took effect on the first day of the year. And police are saying, police unions are saying, well, we want to be able to destroy records going back years, if not decades, so that that misconduct, whatever we did, can't become public and used against us in lawsuits.
Yeah, you know, Paul, this reminds me of a case. I spent a lot of time in Philadelphia, and this reminds me of a situation not too long ago there, where the district attorney's office put together what was essentially like a do not call list of police officers who had...
Right, usually the ones that had either convictions or they've been found to have committed perjury and lied and otherwise fabricated evidence.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, the list was leaked to the media or was published in the media one way or another. And then the police union, I mean, I hate to call them unions, the police associations, the FOP, they freaked out about it. They were so outraged that this information was made public. But doesn't the public have a right to know about the history of misconduct that different officers have?
Well, I would say absolutely. And I think that's one of the realities, though, of the American police state, is that usually often with the connivance of, you know, these police associations like the Fraternal Order of Police, you know, they've created these special rules and other measures that basically thwart any type of even the notion of civilian oversight or accountability or even transparency. Even if you're going to say, hey, you know, the public doesn't really have any control over the police state because we don't, you know, at least we should know how many criminal cops are being employed, how many routinely commit perjury and have been found to have done so. Maybe we can make a decision about whether or not we want police like that being employed on the police forces on the taxpayer nickel. But the reality, though, is that they enact all these secretive measures that are designed to thwart any type of transparency or accountability. And, you know, and these, then that's just part of the reality. And this is a national phenomenon. It doesn't matter, pretty much all 50 states, you see this. And I think to an extent, the biggest problem, though, is the elected officials that go along with all this stuff. Because at the end of the day, it's the elected officials that are making the decision to allow this to continue, whether it's the elected prosecutors, the elected mayors, the elected city councils or commissions. And ironically, the claims that they make is that if we didn't have the secrecy, they wouldn't be able to hire cops. But it's like, if you need secrecy to hire people that routinely break the law, brutalize the citizenry, and commit perjury and stuff like that, do you really want them on the police force? And one of the things that I think gets overlooked is, you know, the police are very well paid in this country. You know, six-figure salaries for police officers are not uncommon in big cities. In fact, they're the norm, more so with when you factor in overtime and stuff. And you think for $100,000 a year, can't we hire someone who doesn't have a conviction for perjury or who doesn't beat their wife?
You know, one of the shames of this whole thing, too, is that the Justice Department doesn't keep figures on crooked cops or cops involved in a wide variety of incidents. We have to rely on outlets like the Washington Post to run databases like this.
Well, they didn't keep track of how many people are killed by the police each year. And this is in the context that this is a country that we keep statistics and figures about everything. I mean, you know, somewhere in the government, they can tell you pretty much down to the last pound, how many soybeans were harvested last year. I mean, we track data, you know, with a minutia that I think is the envy of the rest of the world, except for when it comes to how many people are killed by the police. And I think that tells you the political importance that is attached to that, because no one in a position of power cares how many people are killed by the police. Ironically, when you compare that with not just police that are killed by citizens, but rather just these elaborate trackings that take place for any law enforcement officials that die as they put in the line of duty. So, you know, a cop chokes to death on a donut in a squad car, that's recorded as a line of duty death.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, but if you're comparing the body count, for example, of how many law enforcement officers are actually killed by someone with intent, as opposed to accidents or they have a heart attack while on duty, compared with the number of civilians or citizens that are killed by the police each year, the fact that one set of numbers isn't even tracked by anyone in a position of authority, I think, is I find very troubling. And like you say, we're having to rely on media outlets like the Washington Post and the Guardian to do this. And the reality is, not all police killings are reported in the media. I mean, the level of secrecy that permeates the American police state is really astounding.
Kevin, go ahead.
Well, I just would add that it's really the citizen journalists out there. I know that before there was a formal tracking going on by Washington Post, there was actually a Facebook page that was either killings by police or killings by cops or something of that nature. And they were informally, as best they could, tracking local news reports and posting that someone had been killed today by a police officer. And it was just a running count, a running tally. And every year, of course, they would arrive at 1,000 or more officers, because that's the rate of killings that go on in this country. But you were turning to them, you were requiring on their unscientific analysis, and you know, some of the people who were killed, they missed, and maybe some of the ones that they were killed, you know, maybe there was some kind of inaccuracy. But because the people who are actually professional journalists who claim it as their living to do this on a daily basis, like myself, weren't doing anything more sophisticated or just didn't have the resources to do anything more sophisticated, it fell on them. And there's these cop watch groups that tend to do tracking of these kinds of things to try and compensate for the lack of transparency by getting out, you know, what these officers are doing, by reminding people that these officers, as they commit repeat offenses, that they've been involved in crimes. But you rely on those individuals because the police state is secretive.
Paul, let's move on to our next story here. There's your publication, Criminal Legal News, had an article about the sexual assault and harassment lawsuits filed against members of the Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department, and the enormous burden that this, you know, reprehensible, disgusting behavior is putting on taxpayers. Give us a little bit more details there.
And this is one of the most corrupt sheriff's departments in the whole of the United States.
Yes. Well, basically, we've been reporting on the LA jail and the Los Angeles Sheriff's Office for decades now. And so it turns out that, not surprisingly, the sexual assault is pretty endemic with the Sheriff's Department and the Police Department in Los Angeles. And they've literally been paying out pretty large sums of money in terms of people that have been raped and sexually assaulted by members of the sheriff's office. And one of the things too is, you know, we've been trying to get, speaking of secrecy, you know, we've been trying to get even more information about how much money is paid out in these lawsuits. And so far, the sheriff's department has basically been able to thwart our public records requests. But, you know, what we have been able to get, though, indicates, though, that this is indeed a systemic problem. And the bigger thing, like with everything to do with Los Angeles, is, you know, it's not a recent development. So one case alone, though, involving, and I think one of the things, too, is to, you know, get an idea of the amounts of money we're talking about. In one case alone, the sheriff's department has paid over $72 million in fighting efforts to basically rein them in. So this has been going on, you know, for a long time. And I think it's also important to note that most of this, though, is also within, this isn't just the sexual harassment of the citizenry or suspects or whatever, this is the sexual harassment of their own of their own members, of other deputies and police, and this is kind of like one of those ongoing situations. It's been happening for a long time, and despite the fact that they spend all this money defending themselves, they spend all this money paying out million-dollar settlements and verdicts to the victims, there doesn't seem to be any effort to basically rein it in or stop it.
This sheriff's department, Kevin, in Los Angeles, has had so many problems over the last couple of years. You have deputies accused of raping women. You have deputies accused of stalking women, of abusing power. You have the sheriff himself leaving for prison soon for a three-year term on corruption charges. Why is it that it's taken so long for this information to become public and for the courts and other law enforcement authorities to do something about it, especially in a state like California that's supposed to be so progressive?
I think I would chalk it up to the fact that, any other acts of corruption are protected by these governments, whether we're talking city, county, or state or federal, typically, that any sort of misconduct that these officers engage in is typically protected. Now, on the other hand, this is very egregious conduct. And we're talking about rapes, we're talking sexual assaults. And so I would add that, we have this movement that has been unfolding over the last year or two, the Me Too movement, and it's been largely focused on celebrities who are involved in Hollywood productions and in TV, film, media organizations, people who are on-air broadcast personalities. There have been some politicians, but really, any sort of effort to turn attention towards what is going on in prisons or police hasn't really picked up any traction, even though there are records that are very clear, as is in the case of this sheriff's department. This is really a haven that people have to go after. This is a place where you really have serial rapists who are hiding out, who need to be held accountable. I mean, we had the case of Daniel Holtzclaw that was really sensational. Back in 2015, he was convicted of multiple counts of rape, sexual battery, forcible oral sodomy, and other of these charges. And, he was involved in these kinds of attacks on eight different women. And he was an officer, and he was in Oklahoma. He was part of the Oklahoma City Police Department. It's a very vivid case. It should have put all other departments on notice, and you really should have seen the kind of movement we've seen around police shootings against this kind of sexual misconduct by officers, but you just haven't seen that become a flashpoint of movement. It stayed focused on police brutality of the kind where you fire a weapon and it's seen as it's racial injustice. It's not a thing of gender inequality.
Let's move on now to our next story. Time's going fast. There was a major controversy, over conditions in a freezing jail in Brooklyn, New York. Paul, tell us more about this one.
Sure. One of the things that came up a couple of weeks ago when we're dealing with the polar vortex, I think as the news media call it, of freezing temperatures, it turned out that the federal pretrial detention center in Brooklyn called the Metropolitan Detention Center. Basically, it didn't have, they lost electricity. And with the electricity went the heating. And so over 1,000 prisoners that are being held there for well over a week were in literally freezing temperatures with no heat, and also not a lot as far as food and no light as well, and very limited medical care. And finally, a lawsuit has been filed around 2 weeks ago, a class action lawsuit on behalf of the prisoners seeking damages for their being left in literally dark and freezing conditions for over a week without access to hot food, medical care, water, or attorneys, or access to attorneys or family visits. So the lawsuit's been filed over that, and I guess, we'll see what comes of it. But I think it's one of the things that, when you think about the fact that you've got literally 1,000 prisoners being held in one of the biggest cities of the world under these barbaric conditions, and the fact that really the federal government doesn't have any means or mechanisms to do anything, for these prisoners. Like, they could have just evacuated them to a building that had heat, or they could evacuate them to another prison or to another facility. But rather than do anything like that, that would imply that, you know, if they couldn't adequately heat or light their big prison in New York, they just basically thought, okay, we'll just keep the prisoners locked up, literally locked up in the dark and the cold, and hope no one notices.
Yeah, and there were massive protests, too, once this injustice became widely known. You know, there are hundreds of people who gathered in front of the jail in Brooklyn. Another example, Kevin, of, you know, the importance of grassroots mobilization as these fights are also waged in the courtroom.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think what's valuable about having these kind of lawsuits with these plaintiffs is you have in a public document, you know, this story. I mean, one of the plaintiffs, David Scott, in this lawsuit that we're talking about, it's detailed in there, you know, how he doesn't have access to hot water. It's giving specifics about what it means that there was no heating, what he's going through. I mean, he's a 60-year-old person. When you get old, much older, you know, if the environment isn't, if it's too hot, if it's too cold, I mean, you're very vulnerable to death. So you have to be very careful. I mean, I know that just from the polar vortex hitting Chicago here, for people who were caught outside and couldn't get back in their homes. And that was much more extreme. But still, having these stories is important. And then the grassroots mobilization, it comes. And that's the kind of thing that creates a space for advancing these class action lawsuits, for advancing these other lawsuits. There's two or three that are going to be heard. And it's the sort of thing that puts pressure on the government to have some kind of oversight over, you know, MDC, when they, in fact, would probably prefer to just have the warden do as he pleases.
You know, this was an unusual event, too, at MDC Brooklyn, because the federal judge who was receiving these complaints actually closed her courtroom and went to the MDC because the Bureau of Prisons was denying these prisoners' accounts of the electricity being off, no hot water, people were attempting suicide. One prisoner laid in bed for 5 days with a bullet wound, a gunshot wound, and it was untreated. It was like hell on earth inside the MDC. So she went to the MDC unannounced, took a tour, and said that the Bureau of Prisons has been lying both to the prisoners' families and to the public, and that she was not going to accept a word that they said inside her courtroom. They had proven that they could not be trusted.
And I think, you know, kudos to the judge for doing that. And I think that's one of the things that all too often when we talk about the lack of transparency, when we talk about the lack of accountability, and all too often these police state agencies, you know, they just lie and lie and lie because, you know, no one calls them on it. And, you know, there's no one's actually going out to see, or the people that are directly affected don't have access to the courts. They don't have access to the means of doing that. But, you know, when you have a judge that can, like I say, kudos to her for, you know, getting out of her courtroom, going and taking a look for herself to see what's actually going on. And then the reality collides with, you know, the lies coming out of the police state. And it reminds me of the old Richard Pryor thing of, you know, who are you going to believe, me or your lying eyes? And unfortunately, we don't have as much of that as we should have.
Kevin, on Shadowproof, moving on to a different story, you have an article up here. It's by Brian Sonnenstein. It's about these quote-unquote gladiator fights that maybe are taking place and have taken place in the past and in prisons. I mean, this is like extremely disturbing, but very important information and history that I certainly wasn't aware of. Fill us in on that.
Yeah, I definitely wanted to update. We talked about this a few shows back, but in the last week or two, we got our hands on some video that was shot within these facilities, captured two different fights, and then it was posted, and prisoners insisted that they be published even though they were going to face retaliation. And in fact, as we report here, there are now, officers that are tearing up their cells looking for the device that was used to make these recordings. And in the process, we've had the CDCR, which, you know, is the Corrections Department of California, confirming that there are fights happening. So this isn't just activists or family members fabricating incidents in order to boost some cause. This is actually a serious thing. And what we're talking about here is something called incremental releases. And it's really where they are taking certain groups of prisoners, they're releasing them at the same time, and the people who run the yard, the people who are running the prison, know that these groups are going to get in fights with each other. And very immediately after they are released into the yard, they are sent out and they fire pepper spray or they tear gas them and they separate them. There's two particular groups, the Bulldogs, and then excuse me if I botch this pronunciation, but I think it's the Sereños. And these are two groups that are not able to get along with each other in the Soledad prison. And they, whenever they're put out there, they fight. They've asked not to share the same yard. But and what they're doing very deliberately is they're undermining the ability of prisoners to build any kind of solidarity. They're making it difficult for them to engage in kind of hunger strikes or any resistance that demands more dignity and rights inside prisons. There's actually an agreement that has been in place since 2013 called the Agreement to End Hostilities. It's a kind of peace treaty that was developed between some of these racial groups because, as John can probably attest to and Paul, everything's about identity within prison, about your own racial identity and who you belong to. And so this really threatens that kind of detente. I think that like idea that like you're not going to fight with each other. These gladiator fights are really disruptive, and that's the intent because CDCR wants it to be difficult for them to challenge authority.
The guards will always, always seek to keep people divided because they're afraid. If there were unity among prisoners, that unity would bring power, and that's the last thing that the guards want. Paul, you had your own experience. I mean, with 17 years in prison, you had your own experience with this kind of thing. Would you agree that being in prison is like walking back into 1950s America in terms of racial division and separation?
I think it's in some respects even worse. I think that one of the things that really surprised me was how divided prisoners were by race. And I remember the very first time I walked into the dining hall at the reception center in Washington, and I saw that the prison, I mean, you walk in and literally it's a black and white thing where you've got white prisoners sitting on one part of the chow hall. You've got black prisoners sitting in another place, Hispanics in another place, and Native Americans in another place. And I asked, and there was a black guy in front of me, and I asked him, so did the guards separate us by race here? And he goes, no, we do it ourselves. And he thought that was like a really good thing. And that was one of the things that, you know, for the whole time I was in prison, that's one of the things I was really also really surprised about was kind of how effectively prison officials played and manipulated racial divisions. And it's also one of those things, even where there were none, they tried to foment stuff and create racial divisions. And it's interesting is that while at least nominally government officials in this country, at least at the federal level, have paid at least lip service to the notion of integrating America, for at least the last 40 years or so, when you go to our nation's prisons, it's like anything but. And some places are worse than others. I think that probably California seems to be probably the most racialist prison system in the country where, and it's interesting, where even like the prison guards are divided by race. It's interesting that, you know, like they have a guards union and then they have subsections for white prison guards, for African-American prison guards, for Asian Pacific Islander prison guards, and stuff like that. So, you know, and that just seems to be a system where it's just totally permeated, you know, racism is just totally permeated every level of the prison system, and it has varying degrees, I think, in other places. But now it's definitely been seized upon as a divide-and-conquer mechanism and tool by, you know, by prison officials all over America. They seem to really thrive on it, and they use it very effectively to divide the populations that, as they put it, they manage.
Kevin, we have just about 2 minutes left. There's one more story I'm hoping we can squeeze in here. Somebody who is in prison for 38 years wrongfully has reached a settlement. He's gotten $21 million. Tell us about this case.
Yeah, so in Simi Valley, we've got this prisoner who's 70, and he's 71 years old now. And this revolves around DNA evidence. And again, like in so many of these cases with wrongful death lawsuits, they're trying to overturn, in more dire situations, trying to make sure that the person isn't actually executed and becomes victim of the death penalty. You see these advanced, the fraternal orders of police, they do everything they can to oppose these kinds of lawsuits that are brought against them. Simi Valley is going to be on the hook for $4.9 million of the settlement. So these rack up millions of dollars in taxpayer money that's paid out because of this, you know, basically abuse that goes on. And, you know, there are dozens of these cases. I mean, state by state, I think you can probably find dozens upon dozens of these kinds of cases. And they're so common. And what these cases really should be pointing us towards is sentencing reform, like having some very significant examination of the way in which sentences are addressed. I think we talked previously on the show about going to a standard of maybe the maximum of 20 years, because there are other countries that have that. And that would significantly reduce the monetary costs, and you would have less abuse where people were in the kinds of predicaments that Craig Coley, this prisoner, was in, and, you know, again, pardoned and having a number of years in prison for something he should never have been in prison for.
Paul, we just have a little bit under a minute left. Let's get your thoughts on this, and then we'll take us out.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I think that, you know, so much of our show today is focused on California, and, you know, I think this is part of what, you know, permeates the whole system. You know, you have the secrecy, you have the misconduct, you have the abuse. Some of the ways that manifests itself is people who are wrongfully convicted, they spend decades in prison, and, you know, he's getting $21 million, but I'm not really sure how many people would really want to give up, would want $21 million
yeah,
for 41 years of their lives in a cage. And I think this is also one of the things, too, is the advocates or the apologists for the existing system will say, well, this proves the system worked. And, okay, this is one case of how many others, and how many others are there that the system isn't working for them? And how can you say a system works when a guy winds up doing 41 years in prison for a crime he didn't commit?
We're going to leave it right there. We've been joined from Chicago by Kevin Gastella. He's a writer for Shadowproof.com and co-host of the podcast Unauthorized Disclosure. And we were joined from Lake Worth, Florida, by Paul Wright, the founder and executive director of the Human Rights Defense Center. Paul is also the editor of Prison Legal News and Criminal Legal News magazines. You've been listening to Loud and Clear. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear, with Brian Becker for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. And you can follow us on Twitter at Loud Clear Radio. You can hear us every day, Monday through Friday, from 4 to 6 p.m. on 105.5 FM and 1390 AM in the Washington, D.C. area. You can also hear us at SputnikNews.com and as a podcast on iTunes, iHeartRadio, Spreaker, and Spotify. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. Stay tuned to Radio Sputnik.
Loud and clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR. CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.